The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 20 from the Book of Serenity. Dizang asked, "Where are you going?" Fayan replied, "On an ongoing pilgrimage." Dizang said, "Why do you go on a pilgrimage?" Fayan replied, "I don't know." Dizang said, "Not knowing is most intimate." At these words, Fayan instantly experienced enlightenment. So we've heard now a couple of talks about this koan, and I myself have heard many, many talks about it. From the very first time I ever heard it, it touched me deeply. The not knowing being intimate, the mind that sees through all of the ideas that we carry around in our beautiful brains, the endless stories we make up to explain reality to ourselves, to explain ourselves to ourselves, to explain others to ourselves. I hope you all know that this story-making process is alive in you. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's simply something about how the way minds work, how brains work, these constructed realities that help us to sign up for a sesshin, for example, to boil water for tea. We make up little stories and big stories about how things function. In hearing this story for so many years, and then discovering it when I was working with koans in the Book of Serenity, and then working with it with so many students over the years that I've been privileged to be a teacher, I keep seeing more and more and more in it. And I wanted to know more about Dizang and Fayan too, these two people engaged in this intimate connection of being teacher and student. David mentioned a little bit yesterday that Fayan did not plan to visit Dizang, and how wonderful that not planning is. It's a little bit like not knowing. Not planning, not deciding this is how things are going to be. Hitting the bullseye every time, because there's nothing but the unfolding of this moment, one moment after another. Hongjir, who collected the 100 cases in the Book of Serenity, and then maybe a century later, these were commented on by another teacher, Wansong. But Hongjir, who we read today about his beautiful text about wandering into the center of the circle of wonder, this theme of wandering that we've been looking into together. He has a poem that is amended to this this koan that contains this line. Oh, I don't have it right with me. Well, it contains the line, following wherever your footsteps take you. And this following of our footsteps, this is the Zen path for me. It's not a path like the Massachusetts Turnpike is a path. It's a path that creates itself with each footstep. Years ago, when I was teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction, we used to share cartoons and poems and all kinds of things like that. And someone brought in a beautiful cartoon of someone walking on a tightrope and holding the rope in their hand and laying it out for each footstep. It's a little bit like that. We don't know where we're going, and yet we can't stay put. We can't say, okay, I've got it, I'm done, because we're never done. Many of us work on koans in Boundless Way, and that's a really tricky thing because we talk about a koan curriculum. We think, oh, I have completed these koans or this koan, or I've completed all of them, and that makes me somebody special. But of course, that's not true. The koan curriculum is a little bit of a bait and switch, because I can tell you, having gone through it many, many, many times, I still have not gone all the way to the depths of it. These stories of the ancient masters, mostly Tang Dynasty masters, the stories that were collected in the Sung Dynasty, which happened later, they're inspiring, but they might not be completely true. True in the sense of fact-based, which is so important to us now in the 21st century, but I have to say, based on my experience, not so important to me. What are the facts? Years ago, I worked for a clinic as a psychotherapist where survivors of homicide victims would come and they would gather to tell their really awful stories about their loved ones being murdered. And because of that experience, I got to accompany them sometimes to court to see what happened to the perpetrators of these terrible crimes. And boy, it was pretty much all over the map. The halls of justice, I would say in my experience, were the halls of telling stories that would create a sense of the person telling the story as the hero or heroine of their own story. And a lawyer that I got to know through that experience said to me, "Don't you know the phrase, he lies like an eyewitness?" We're always changing, contaminating the events of our life to put them into some kind of a way of explaining things. This construction business, as my first teacher used to call it, the constructing of reality. Everybody does it. And it's not something that I think we need to stop doing, but I do believe that we need to see it as it's happening. It's so tempting to concretize a story where we're the hero, when everybody else involved in the story has their own viewpoint, their own way of explaining reality to themselves. Some of you know the movie, the Japanese movie Rashomon from 1950, actually, a story based on a novel that's famous for what is now called the Rashomon effect. Many movies that talk about having unreliable narrators. In the original movie, a samurai is murdered and his wife is raped. And we get to hear the story told four different times. One time by the bandit himself, who's accused of the crime of murdering the samurai. One time by the wife, the victim of rape, who watches her husband being murdered. One time by an eyewitness, a woodcutter who sees the whole thing, and then they even get the samurai to come through as a ghost to tell his version of the story. The movie doesn't come down on one side or the other or the other or the other. It's a demonstration of how unstable our stories are, how human it is to not understand how things are really happening, to grab on to a couple of things and hold on to them for dear life and ignore everything else in order to construct the story. And not just with ourselves as heroes. I think we often construct stories where we're the villain. We did something wrong or did something terrible or hurt somebody, or that God is the villain, or some other person is the hero, or whatever. On and on and on we go. And Zen is a very radical way of understanding reality, because the teachings in Zen keep saying, don't be so sure. This not knowing itself can be concretized. It can become a fetish. Oh yeah. No, I'm a person who doesn't know. And there's a wonderful koan also, a different koan, where the teacher Nanchuan says to his young 19-year-old disciple Zhaozhou. Some of you know Zhaozhou in other contexts as the hero of many koan stories, but in this one, he's young. And Nanchuan says to him, it's not knowing or knowing. Not knowing is blankness, and not know and knowing is a delusion. So where do we fall then? Where's the place to cling? Where's the place to hold on to for dear life? Well, we say that the place to hold on to for dear life is our Zazen practice itself. This stillness in the body, while the mind and the heart and other parts of the body go on and on and on, doing their thing, the rising and falling away of emotions, the rising and falling away of physical sensations. And I think the thing that traps most of us who are well educated, at least, but I think everybody in this culture for sure, the mind making its arisings, the sixth sense of thoughts that rise and fall and rise and fall, and we gather them as if we were fisher people gathering a net, and we string a few of them together and say, that's it, that's it. But the life-saving quality of being present, if you're doing breath practice, to the breath in the center of the body, not necessarily the breath in the respiratory system, but this subtle movement of the abdomen in and out, getting lost in whatever phenomena are arising, and then coming back to this. Or maybe you're doing Shikan Taza, just sitting practice, and that practice is allowing a big panoramic view of all of the phenomena that come and go, that rise and fall, without grabbing on to any of them. And if you do grab onto any of them, you know that you've grabbed on. And then the next thing unfolds, and then the next thing. And if you're working with a koan, the koan becomes something that colors or maybe even saturates either of these practices with a story. A constructed story that comes from somebody else. Remember, they're all stories. What can we do with these stories? How can we practice with them so that we learn how to practice with our own stories? That's why almost every sesshin, we take up a story from our ancestors and look into it and turn it around and get to know it. I was very struck when I was doing research on this koan that there's a completely different version, a Rashomon version of the story of Dizang and Fayan. In Fayan's own record, that is the record of stories about Fayan, not one that he wrote himself, but that somebody, some disciple or someone took all the things they knew, all the stories they knew about Fayan and strung them together. And when he meets Dizang in the record of Fayan, it goes like this. Remember, David said that Fayan hadn't meant to study with Dizang, but he and two other friends of his were trapped at the Dizang monastery by a snowstorm. So the story goes that when the snow was gone, they all started to leave, the three monks. But Dizang, as he accompanied them to the gate, asked them a question. He said, I've heard you several times say that the three realms are only mind and the myriad dharmas are only consciousness. Now, that's an interesting thing for him to say as these three guys are leaving. And it's a testing question. He wants to hear one last thing from them about their insight. And interestingly, that is the question that Disang was asked by his teacher, Xuanzha, just before his own awakening. A simplified version of it, but more or less the same. And in that dialogue, which I'll begin to tell you, Xuanzha questioned Dizang, saying, "In the three realms, there's only mind. How do you understand that?" And Dizang pointed to a chair. This is the student, pointed to a chair and said, "What does the master call that?" And Xuanzha, the teacher, said, "It's a chair." And Dizang said, "Then the master can't say that in the three worlds there's only mind." Xuanzha said, "I see that it's made from bamboo and wood. What do you say it's made from?" And Dizang said, "I also say it's made from bamboo and wood." Xuanzha said, "I've searched across the great earth for a person who understands the Buddha Dharma." And then in the way of these stories, he doesn't say, "And you're the one." He says, "But I haven't found one." Dizang knew his meaning and stayed with him and studied with him for many years and became a well-known teacher himself, although not a really famous teacher. He kind of kept to himself. So at this point in his life, he asks the same question of these three monks who showed up in the snowstorm. And then after he asks that question, he points not to a chair, but to a rock that's lying on the ground right by the entry gate, by the exit gate. And he says, "So, do you say that this rock is inside or outside of the mind?" Fayen immediately said, "Inside the mind," because he held to this teaching too, that everything was constructed, there was no reality. Dizang said, "How can a pilgrim like you carry such a rock in his mind while on pilgrimage?" And Fayan was dumbfounded, according to this story, and he couldn't answer. And here's the moment in the story. There's a couple of moments in the story that really touched me. He put his luggage down at Dizang's feet. Imagine the scene. All this Zen stuff has been going on, one of these dialogues that feels fairly incomprehensible. So close to a Western philosophical story, isn't it? About, is that rock there in your mind or on the ground? And, "Oh, it's in my mind. Well, wow, it must be very heavy in there." I can't remember who said that. Maybe one of you knows. But here it is again occurring on the other side of the planet at another time. In another situation. But it's the same thing. What is the nature of reality? We want to know. Why do I suffer? Why are things so difficult? Oh, I know, because, and then we have our favorite stories to explain it. How amazing then, this putting down of the luggage at the teacher's feet. How many of us are willing to do this? How many of us are willing to put it all down? To say, "I don't know," not as a fetish or a story, but, "Whoa, I'm really, really stuck. I don't get it, and I really want to get it. I thought I was on pilgrimage, but I see that I have to stay here because there's something I just don't get." He put down his luggage right at Dizang's feet, and then he asked him for his teaching. This is one of the traditions in this Zen practice of getting to the end. As Wu Men says, at the end, it's like an iron wall. To get to the end of all of the story making and all the strategies and all the ways we have of pretending that we understand something when really the great mystery As Hongjie says in the text we read earlier, we wander into the center of the circle of wonder, this wondrous life that is right in front of us all the time, that never lets up being aliveness. It can't help itself. The birds and the wind and the trees and other people in their beautiful unconsciousness. Everything demonstrating the Dharma, rocks and walls and tiles, as one teacher said. Everything demonstrating the Dharma, but we don't see it because we're busy looking somewhere else for something else, something we call enlightenment, something we call Zen even. And this is where teachers come in. Teachers are human beings, all of us, all the people, the transmitted teachers and the senior assistant teachers in Boundless Way and every spiritual teacher who ever lived on the planet, including the Buddha, human beings who get up in the morning and go to the toilet, who eat and drink and walk and sit and lie down. All of us human beings, but sometimes for some people, there's a kind of an opening that to the truth that then gets trained so that we can be guides in the dark woods of delusion, in the dark woods of suffering and pain and difficulty that is so characteristic of this life. So to be guided, to put down your luggage, you have to be dumbfounded. You can't just pretend, oh yeah, I'm going to be a student now. I'm going to bow to these teachings. That's just one more constructed story. Coming to the end of knowing is a phrase that I, in this very moment, came up with and prefer to I don't know. I have come to the end of my knowing. I've come to the end and I want guidance. Show me the way. And this is just what Fayan does with Dizang. And so the story goes on to say that every day for the next month or so, I like that, the next month or so, we don't know how long this went on for. And of course, this is a story. We don't really know if this happened. Fayan spoke about the way with Dizang, and every time he tried to demonstrate his understanding, he came in, we might say, for endless doksans, and tried to explain how the way was unfolding for him. And every time, Dizang would say the same thing. He would say, the Buddha Dharma isn't like that. The Buddha Dharma, the teachings of the awakened one, it isn't like that. And finally, Fayan said this, and this is the second point that made me want to share this story with you because it touched me so deeply. It's another way of putting down his luggage, but this time, after how long? Of trying, let me show you how wonderful I am, how much I know. He says, I've run out of words and ideas. I've run out of words and ideas. This running out, this coming to Doksan with open hands, this coming into the teacher-student relationship, listening to this talk, coming to Sesshin, participating in Dharma dialogue. We speak in these moments, don't we? I'm speaking now. And in a little while, some of you will speak, and then later, every one of you will get to speak to a teacher. But this is a speaking that eventually comes through us after we've run out of words and ideas. This is a very precious place to be. It's not itself an idea. I believe reading this that Fayan genuinely had run out of gas. Nothing was left. He had tried his best. We see this in many, many of these constructed stories that we call koans, that we've inherited, that we explore. The moment when we run out of words and ideas is the moment when something new can be available. And Dizong sees his opportunity. When Fayan says, "I've run out of words and ideas," Dizong says, "If you want to talk about Buddha Dharma, if you want to talk about the teachings of the Buddha, everything you see embodies it. Everything you see embodies it. If you want to talk about Buddha Dharma, everything you see embodies it." And here we have a return in a way to the condensed and altered version of the story that we use as our koan. Not knowing is most intimate. Everything you see embodies what you're looking for. The teachings, as Layman Pang's daughter Ling Zhao said, are written on every blade of grass. There are no exceptions to this. It's not all nice stuff. It's also the pain in my knee. It's also finding out that a good friend of mine may have cancer. It's finding out that all of us are on this earth for some limited amount of time. And the importance of this practice gets clarified at these moments. Pain in the knee, the loss of a friend, everything that occurs, everything glistens with its own light. Everything reveals the mysterious truth of the Tathagata. And at these words, Fayan experienced his great enlightenment. Who knows what really happened? It's Rashomon all over again. But what we do know, the very little we really know about Fayan, was that he went on to become a teacher, and he had many, many, many students. One text says he had 1,000 students. That would be interesting. And he established, one of his disciples established a form of Buddhism called Fayan Buddhism, and it lasted a long time. But we don't really know any of this for sure. These are like fairy tale characters. They are like me and you. They're not some historical figure who gets written down in a book and then that's the fact. They're like dreams. They're like clouds floating in the sky. They arise and they disperse. And we use them when we encounter them. If they truly touch our hearts, then we can be taught. Then we can find our way to what the Buddha taught. And even that is just a bunch of stories. But I don't know about you, they really touch me. Dizong asked, "Where are you going?" Fayan replied, "On an ongoing pilgrimage." Dizong said, "Why do you go on a pilgrimage?" Fayan replied, "I don't know." Dizong said, "Not knowing is most intimate." At these words, Fayan instantly experienced enlightenment. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue, and you know what to do. Yes, Lisa.
Thank you for your talk. The talks on this Sesshin have been really helpful to me. And yesterday, I went for my usual walk. I have a path that I take, and I do it for exercise, and it's like 3.5 miles. And I usually am tuned into, I put my earbuds in, and I may listen to a Dharma talk or something from Audible fiction. But this time I decided I would, since I'm on retreat, I would go without any external entertainment. And the words came to me that not knowing is the most intimate. And the walk was transformed. I noticed the patterns of the leaves on the ground, and I slowed down. I didn't take the full route. I shortened it so that I could not rush like I usually do getting in my aerobic exercise. And it was more beautiful. And I didn't maintain it the whole time. I couldn't put down my heavy luggage that I carried around or that boulder in my head. But I put it down for a little bit, and I felt really nurtured and briefly at peace. So I wanted to share that, and thank you for the teaching.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. So wonderful. This possibility, and I think it's especially vivid in these Zoom retreats, these at-home retreats, to the possibility of doing what we always do, going where we always go in some new way, right? How do we enter into this world of suchness? Well, exactly where you have always been, the path you have always walked, and this the possibility of slowing down, of paying attention. And I love that you did not have a great enlightenment that transformed you completely, but you had a moment, you and the world, you and the Dharma kind of met and had a little, just a little kiss together. How sweet, right? And these are not things that can be controlled or things that can be held on to, but yet when we touch and are touched, we are changed. And we can leave everything where it is, because that moment then becomes part of the luggage. We put it in the suitcase and carry it home. And I don't hear you doing that. I hear you appreciating, holding open hand. Wow, how amazing. Yeah.
Thank you. Bix.
Yeah, thanks so much, Melissa. So I really appreciate this sort of not knowing. And it's something that's been, I think, really helpful for me and really, really important for my practice. And I think that this sort of not knowing in the context of like working with koans, these stories, is really interesting and puzzling and confusing. Because these koans, when you work with them, there's this message that you're supposed to sit with the koan until you understand this message, and there's a correct message, and there's an like an incorrect message, and so how do you sort of balance those two things of not knowing and just sort of letting whatever comes to you come to you, and doing so in a way where you get the correct message, I guess.
Well, it seems like your question is exactly to the point. I think you know how to do it. Say more about what you're discovering, that you've got two different ways of entering into it. What's that like for you?
Well, it's frustrating because like I feel like I've, like there is a message that might come, and then it's not the correct one, but I feel like I've still learned something important. And I guess it's maybe the point is to sit with it without trying to get it, and if you don't get it, that's fine too.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. Well, while you were talking, I just got an image of going on a trip. You know, I'm going to go to Boston, for example. And all along the way, there are all these different things that I might encounter. You might have to pull off the road and go to a restaurant, or I see something and I want to stop. And so, or just some car on the road if I'm driving on the pike. And you know, I haven't gotten to Boston, but I'll get there. But then there's all these other riches that I keep encountering, and it sounds like that's what you're talking about, and that is how I understand the practice—not just koan practice, but all the practices that we do in Zen. There's just discovery after discovery after discovery. So I hear that that's happening, and they're valuable, and they're valuable. And still, you know, you keep going because. Yeah, it's a bullseye when the arrow goes out into the Pacific Ocean, but it's also all already accomplished. So that means that everything that arises, everything you see, as Dzogchen said, is the teaching. There are no exceptions to that. So getting through a koan, you know, I always tell the story, and if you haven't heard it yet, my first koan, I sat for 9 years with it until it opened itself to me. To the satisfaction of my teacher. Now, those 9 years were not wasted. All kinds of things happened, all kinds of insights and discoveries. And but, so it wasn't about the koan, it was something about the persistence and the attitude of just feeling totally frustrated sometimes. Yeah, so very good, good frustration.
And Vic, so it's helpful to remember that the point of working on koans really isn't to answer the koan, it's to wake up to your life. And you may, as Melissa said, work on a koan for 9 years. And if you got the answer to that but didn't wake up, it would be a waste of time. But if you never got it and woke up, it would be wonderful. So that it's not about the point of answering it and having the teacher nod and send you know, it's waking up to this precious one life.
And also, any of you who work on koans know that if you, in quotes, pass a koan, you just get another koan. It's not like, even if you, again, in air quotes, complete the curriculum, there's no completion. That's another delusion. So this ongoing practice, one step after the other.
And I think, as Melissa said in her talk, even those of us who have been working on the koan curriculum, some of us keep going over it again and again. I guess being a teacher is a kind of remedial practice. And the wonderful thing about these koans is the riches that they bring to us and bring to us in the conversations with each of you. So yes, there is some way that each koan is pointing, but each koan is all of life itself. So how to value all of that?
Thank you so much, Bix. Yes, Corwin.
And thank you to Lisa and Bix for their comments also, because I was just thinking about how when I came here this morning, and actually I did the same thing yesterday, you know, I got on my scooter and I didn't put in earplugs, I didn't turn on the music, I just experienced the ride, you know, feeling the breeze and not too much traffic. And you know, so there was that letting go of the externals, but also I put on my helmet. And you know, I knew, don't lean too much over that painted line. So it's not like we just completely blindly go in, you know, not knowing anything. And like these koans, you know, you can't just completely clear everything. We're still affected by everything we've learned or thought we learned, everything we've experienced in the past, and how it's a not knowing and yet still also informed, and we're still present there. It's not just la 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 and, you know, doing whatever. And it's not good to put all the luggage down. So we it stays with us. We can't put it down. So
Well, I think you really point to something that for me is one of the hallmarks of Zen, of what it means to be free. You could say, oh, I'm free now, so I don't wear a helmet when I ride my scooter anymore. I never do what I'm supposed to because I'm free. I've seen through it. But this wonderful, probably a good idea to wear a helmet when we ride a bike or a scooter or Harley Davidson, whatever you're riding these days. but in that putting on the helmet, in the eating breakfast, in the fulfilling our role, the freedom comes. It's not one or the other. And I appreciate you really highlighting that. But the spirit of it transforms it. So we might think, oh, okay, don't listen to podcasts is the message here, right? If only I don't. So it's not that either. We can do the same old thing in some new way, but sometimes these unplugging can be a wonderful thing. Sometimes plugging in a new way, really plug in, see what happens. So even though Michael encouraged us to be wild and dangerous, always take what Zen teachers say with a grain of salt.
And you know, there's something too, we talk about this a lot, about the misunderstanding of what it means to let go, right? So putting down the luggage, it's a wonderful metaphor, but you can't put it down until you actually feel the grip of it in your hand. It's very important that we notice how hard we're holding on to these stories that I was talking about, to conceptions, to ideas. Because if we just try to cast it to the winds, it's both what you're saying, Corwin, and what David just commented on, and it's also all of these things are here for a reason. They rose up in us to protect us, to take care of us, to show us the way, you know, all the stories, the luggage we're carrying, everything. It is not something to be just thrown away, but to feel the weight of it is so important. And then my experience again is that once you feel that grip, the body just wants to start loosening around it, and it will leave by itself. But you can't do it as a straight, you can't hold on to it tightly as a strategy to let it go. We like to say to let it be, you know, opening the hand of thought, loosen the grip, but feel it. So just another wrinkle on what you were both saying. Oh, thank you. Madhu.
Thank you for your talk, Melissa Roshi. So when you were speaking, I was touched by how you connected with the teacher and also the student putting down the luggage. It sort of showed me your inspiration and your aspirations as a teacher and how much you want to help us all. So that's what I connected with. Thank you.
Wow. And you raising your hand and saying that, I feel like part of being a teacher is not just wanting to help people, but this exchange, constant exchange. So I feel very touched by what you said, not because it's praise. Praise is nice.
But I really felt it. I think it's
yes.
It was
felt genuine to what you experienced. So thank you.
Well, and then it's this reflective quality. Mm-hmm. You feel this because it touch, you know this place of wanting and simply and generosity. And so we see it, you see it in Melissa, and it sparks in you, and you bring that forward. And we say the great round mirror. We think things are outside us or inside us, but this great round mirror is reflecting constantly. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Jenny.
Yes, thank you for the talk, Melissa. I appreciated your I've come to the end of knowing phrasing. And I don't know, just thinking about like having been a geek all my life, and like I want to know this, and I'm gonna get to the bottom of this and turn this thing inside out and do all the problems and know it through and through, and having entered the path with that, yes, with that mind. And then just gradually, I don't know if it's the path or if it's just getting old and tired, but almost, yeah, almost turning around, like not really losing curiosity or anything, but just like, yeah, that's a hill I'm not going to charge up. Yeah. But still being like completely dedicated to this path to nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not just not demanding, I guess.
Well, I love that. I love everything you just said. And you know, I came on the path with a desire to know. I was college educated and research driven, and you know, all this sort of stuff. I wanted to, and everything I did intellectually was to know more, know more, know more. And that's still present. It's not something, you know, to get rid of. It led me to do the research on Fayan, for example. And what did I find? Did I find a set of facts? Okay, now I know who Fayan was. No, I found more Rashomon stuff that I don't know who he was. But I did, you know, and this connects to what Madhu was just saying. I did feel touched. There were these glimmers of something that I already know, right? So beyond knowing, but I know this. I know what that feels like. I've run out of words. That's great. I know that feeling. The frustration that Bix was talking about. So it's the whole thing. There isn't anything that needs to be, I say this a lot, cut out and disposed of.
Yeah.
Everything is our Dharma. You, as a geek, are the perfect example of a geek Buddha. Right? It's wow. How lucky we are to have encountered each other in this lifetime.
And yes. You know, Jenny, it's important to know that not knowing is not willful ignorance. It's this. You said I like to turn things over. This is wonderful. The turning the things over that are arising right here, right now. That's that spirit you have. That bodhicitta, bringing that to bear on this moment where your life is. That's so important. Don't feel, I hope you don't see that as something that's baggage that you need to put down. That's wonderful.
Yeah, no, I got a picture of turning over a rock, and it's like, oh, look at all those lovely little critters crawling around under there and getting a glimmer. So, yeah. Wow. Thank you.
Craig.
Thank you for that talk, Melissa. And this dialogue is touching right on what was alive for me, this not knowing. I mean, all my life, I've seen not knowing as a problem to solve. I mean, I would get a red check mark from the grade school teacher on my math paper, and that's a problem to fix. And even my career, I was a knowledge worker. People paid me to know things. And to be comfortable with not knowing, there's still this, it's a fault. There's this story that resonates in my mind that when I don't know, that's a problem to be solved. And when I, you know, when a teacher bows me out of the Doksan room because I need to sit with that koan some more, you know, it's a little struggle to say thank you for that. But
Right.
it just, you know, I don't have the answer here. It's just that the this not knowing as a path that's worth following runs up against everything I've been taught all my life.
Yeah. And again, to not make it dualistic, because, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking of all the people I'm grateful to who know things. Like when David and I have been to the emergency room a number of times over the last couple of years. Thank goodness the ambulance drivers knew what they were doing, and the emergency room doctors and nurses and the techs. Everybody had a knowledge pool that it was one I didn't have. And even if I'd had it, I still needed them to enact it. So knowledge is not the enemy either. Right, all the things you've learned are so useful. It's when it gets out of balance, you know, that you cannot know everything. I cannot do all the research. Jenny can't get all the technical details. We're part of a big, vast network of knowing. So part of the relief for me is I know what I know, and I can't go beyond that. That is the whole thing right there. And then, you know, then I can enjoy the other side of that. That's what I think you're experiencing now, is the enjoyment of a fully balanced life of knowing, not knowing, and wondering and wandering. It's pretty cool.
So standing at that threshold of knowing and not knowing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
Yes.
and you know what we're talking about here is just so interesting because it's not about willfully not being who we think we are, right? So I'm the one who thinks a lot, or I'm the one who's this or that,
Yes.
and I'm just gonna put that down. That's what Melissa said. Put those bags down. Well, they're glued on. And we need them, and they are the path. And the only way to this edge is to follow and to try everything we can, to try that old strategy, really invest in it, you know, everything. And eventually, if we're lucky, we get old and tired. And maybe we get old and tired in one day. This is not a matter of chronological years. But then this very thing that was such a problem transforms by itself. Not because I'm so clever or anything, but it reveals itself, but only if we keep going and keep going and keep going.
Right. And also, I think, Craig, what struck me so much in what you're saying is that what you know is really valuable, and you're so much more than what you know. So this relates to the story of the self that we keep talking about endlessly, endlessly. Well, I'm a person who's a geek, or I'm a person who's a researcher, or I'm a person who's a knowledge person. That's just a very limited view of what's possible for us as human beings. And so it has to be embraced. The story of the self is this little tiny part of who we are. And then there's more, it's vast. So, yeah, come on in. Let's take two more, Pierce and Susan Lamar. So we'll start with Pierce.
So thanks, Melissa, and everybody. The part of the talk that intrigued me was the moment when Fayyan says, "I'm totally confused." And I know that moment. In fact, I'm here right now. But I'm not sure that and I've been there many times, actually. I'm not sure that I have had the same response as Fayyan. I used to walk around on retreats with my hand on my car keys, as though, and say to myself, any moment I can split if I need to, if I want to. I don't think I ever did it. But I noticed that, talk about knowing. I noticed that I'm trying to figure out, I'm doing it right now. What is the nature of this retreat? What happened to me on this retreat? And my sense is that I don't know that, but what I do know is that the retreat is moving me from delusive certainty to something else. And I think I felt it very strongly during David's talk also that he's describing the ways in which we make up stories about our experience and the ways in which they just don't hold water. So we're moving toward a place of, you might call it confusion, but it's also the intimacy of actual not knowing. And then, having gotten there, I want to say, to finish by saying, as you have been saying also, Melissa, that this knowledge has a function, and it's not really different from, the, I don't know, it's not to be discarded. So with Corwin, I say, don't throw away your helmet. Thank you.
Pierce, I really appreciate what you're saying, and I'm thinking of Fayyan saying, I've come to the end of my words and ideas, and the enormous amount of courage it takes to do and say that. It's all well and good to say, I don't know, not knowing's the teaching, da 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 da, but to sit and stand in front of a teacher and say, I don't know, and truly let go. There's so much there that requires so much of us to do that. It's not an easy path, and that's why we're here doing this for a whole weekend. Continue to do this. It takes that much effort and to continue to return.
I love that image of that you're bringing us, Michael, of Fayyan, really standing there and saying this. And I think so many of you, as you learn how to come into Doksan and really show who you are, it's not I've run out of words and ideas necessarily. It's more like I'm so frustrated, or I'm so anxious, or I'm so depressed or angry. I'm so angry. And there's a certain point where we begin to see that all of those things are the Buddha Dharma manifesting themselves. So, and they all contain part of the teaching of the Great Vehicle is that they all contain the jewel of awakening, but not if we keep tangling them up with more and more stories, like I'm depressed because fill in the blank, or I'm angry because is not so helpful. That's just adding more ideas, more stories, but I'm just feeling like this now. And owning it, almost like embracing it, and seeing how, as the Tibetans say, it's kindly bent to ease us. This fullness of life. So running out of words and ideas and everything else that arises in us, that's the teaching. And what we do when we're in Doksan or in a Dharma dialogue like this is we come forward as what's arising now. And then get met by someone who's been doing the same thing for a while, might not be a full expert at it, but sees where there's a possibility of getting lost. And I see that happening with Fayyan and Disang. Disang was very patient with him. He met with him for every day for a long, for months probably, until this moment happened. So, the idea is to keep bringing it, keep bringing it.
Well, it's such a paradoxical thing because we talk about, well, I'm confused, but I love what Melissa and Michael are saying, that in some way, this is really knowing. You're presenting what you know, what you really know, not what you think about your opinion about it. I am confused, right? And there is a way this is presenting the truth of our knowing. And requires great courage, whatever it is. Doesn't have to be confusion, can be presenting the truth of clarity or openness or anything.
Joy.
Yeah, there it is.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Susan Lamar.
Yes, wow. Thank you to everybody. This morning is enormously powerful. I've been thinking about the paradox, or sort of sitting on the paradox between words. I'm another person who's, been a word person all my life, and not knowing. And, to come in not knowing and then being asked, well, say more about not knowing. trying not to. And yet, I guess I would not use the word confusion. I would use the word paradox, because I've always absolutely loved floating in paradoxes. And where I feel like I am between the words and the not knowing is when you put two like poles of a magnet together, and there's this pressure pressing both directions, and it just won't go. That's kind of where I am between the words and the not knowing, and right in that paradox. And as I said, it's my favorite place to be in the whole world, is in that kind of tension. And so this whole morning has kind of put me there. So it'll be interesting to see, creative curiosity, where what's next? If we've been saying that, for a day and a half now, what's next? Do I fall out? Well, probably. Do I get to stay in? Well, yeah, probably.
Well, that's where there's true not knowing. Because we really don't know what's going to happen next. It's one surprise after the other on the scooter.
And I love that image of the magnets, because there is an energy that sometimes we're in the middle of. This is some of you may have noticed it's not always placid and sweet as we meditate. It can be quiet and still and vibrating. This field of aliveness appears in so many ways and requires some courage and determination when you're there to do nothing, right? And this kind of faith I think you're speaking of. Oh, I wonder what it will be, this next breath. I wonder where it will lead. Yeah, we'll see.
Wander into the center of the circle of wonder. There it is. Okay, well, thank you, Susan, and thank you, everybody. Let's come back to our sitting posture.